Right, good evening, Bodhisattvas. Tonight is going to be really prose, so I thought I would just go back to something Connie mentioned last night and start with a little poetry, and then no more poetry tonight. So I was thinking about what you were saying about cats and dogs and stuff, and I still want to say that I have no idea what a Zen epistemology of animals would be. You know, it's a really complicated thing. But I do remember when I was working on Whitman, I guess still as a graduate student, and he's got a certain sort of Zen-like quality sometimes, and sometimes really not. But my teacher, Quentin Anderson, was in a book sort of describing the state of consciousness that he thought Whitman aspired to. And he said it was like a cat with the ability to apprehend its cathood, you know, which in a way seems like the kind of meditative awareness that Alok was just talking about, or you know, the sort of awareness of awareness, or presence and presences, or silence and sounds. And so, anyway, here's a little thing from Whitman about animals. It's from Song of Myself, which is a tiny section. So, this is the We Like Animals part of the show. I think I could turn and live with animals. They are so placid and self-contained. I stand and look at them long and long. They do not sweat and whine about their condition. They do not lie awake in the dark and weep for their sins. They do not make me sick discussing their duty to God. Not one is dissatisfied. Not one is demented with the mania of owning things. Not one kneels to another, nor to his kind that lived thousands of years ago. Not one is respectable or industrious over the whole earth. So. So. We can kind of get back there, but kind of not. So I want to say also, that this may be an incredibly bad idea, but I'm committed to it anyway. And so this is was William James night, and so you may feel like you wandered into the wrong building at the Redemptorist Renewal Center, and the Zen retreat's down the road, and they somehow put an undergraduate, you know, philosophy or literature class here. So let's see how it goes. The reason for it, I guess, is, you know, ever since I started working with Joan, I had a sense that a lot of what she was doing when she sort of talked about carrying a Zen awareness out into the world had some relation to James and pragmatism, and she said that was true. And so I always keep sort of promising or threatening that one day we'll get around to talking about James, and so I thought we would finally, you know, do it and then maybe put it behind us forever. But I think it has some relation to the kind of things I was trying to bring up last night. So it's going to be a little awkward too, because I couldn't, it's a lot of quotations from a philosophy book, and I couldn't type them all, so I'm going to be thumbing through pages a little bit. And I guess when it gets too dense, I'll try to slow down a little bit and paraphrase. And if it gets too long, which I don't think it will, but if it gets really long, I'll sort of break off and we can wrap it up, not tomorrow night, which is the Cohen seminar, but on Saturday evening, when I'll go on to talk about a little bit of other stuff as well. And mentioning the Cohen seminar, the Cohens for the seminar, which is tomorrow night, there are copies out on the bench outside if you want to grab one tonight. And I'll try to bring some more tomorrow.
All right.
No, different ones. Yeah, and too many, you know. But so, pick and choose. All right. Last night we left off with the Lanka, and left it, or hoped to, behind. But not so fast, or not quite so fast. We need to use it to push off of. To recall that the Lanka uses conceptual language to show that all conceptions are projection only, is to note that it swallows its own tail, a predicament of which it's well aware. So it must propound its propositions not as absolute truth, but as skillful means, as a map or model which, while not absolutely true, might be useful to someone, or to a lot of someones. It might, let's say, liberate us from some other mistaken views to which we are glued. The views say that right concepts will allow us absolutely to know absolute reality and replicate it with absolutely correct propositions. Zen calls this usefulness skillful means. The American philosopher William James called it instrumental value, the usefulness of some of our particular propositions, judgments, and models in putting us in fruitful touch with the world. He called his version of doing philosophy pragmatism to highlight its focus on models not viewed as perfect copies of reality, but instead as instruments that have some practical utility in negotiating our place in the world. D.T. Suzuki predicted that Zen would thrive in America in part because of its affinity to pragmatism, the dominant homegrown strain in American philosophy, an affinity I hope you can already sense in what I've said so far. So I want to turn to James tonight in the spirit of the PCI open source project of dreaming on an American Zen that draws on our own native traditions. I also want to ward off Zen Orientalism. The sensei that the Lanka's sometimes mind-bending claims result simply from its origin in the mysterious Orient. In lots of ways, the Lanka is just a short jump from William James. There are important differences, of course, and they bring us back to the perspective of Shito's poem, which we'll talk about a little bit on Saturday, but not tonight. The Lanka's hyperbolic-sounding claim that all views are projection only might be a skillful means way of getting us to turn the mind around and tumble off our perches as knowers, back down into our place as creatures in the world, where really we already were. It's interested in generating moments where all our conceptions appear to us as just more rising and falling in the peace and tranquility of awareness or sky. The Alaya Vijnana turned around into Tathagata Garbha, the womb of the Buddhas. That's not the project of James's lectures collected in the book Pragmatism, though in some of his other work, James devotes a lot of attention to religious mysticism. But the Lanka is also a bodhisattva manual, so it tosses us back into the marketplace where we can do some good. And the Lanka says it's useful as we return to the marketplace to see perfected reality, the vantage from which we know projections as projection only. Or a little more realistically, where we're neither confused nor not confused by our delusions. That actually sounds fairly close to James's take on our concepts and models. Maybe we can put it like this. Even, or especially in the marketplace, it's a good thing not to be wholly confused by our models or enthralled to them. It's good to see right through them sometimes, or almost. But in James, the other side of the Lanka's formulation that even the wise remain partly confused by their models, which sounds in the Lanka like an unavoidable evil, gets a little twist. So in the Lanka, it doesn't seem to be necessarily great that you're still partly confused by your propositions. If the Lanka seems to suggest that to buy into a model is in some crucial way always to be duped, James instead stresses the utility of models, or some models. If we're going to do stuff in the world, and what else can a bodhisattva do, we need models and maps. We need to see through our models in the sense of seeing the world by means of them in the shapes the model generates. So investing in them isn't wholly a bad thing. We just don't want to get seduced by the power of one particular model or regard it as absolute truth. In last night's terms, we need to soften our relation to our models. That can help make us more flexible and useful. It can also soften ourselves or sense of selves. One more related difference of emphasis. While the Lanka stresses projections as projections only, James tends to regard them as, well, projections partly. It really is a difference of emphasis and not an epistemological gunfight. Like the Lanka, James insists that there's no conceptual experience that's outside of conceptual experience. We can never test our models against some absolute, completely non-human reality unaffected by our perceptual categories and human ways of processing sense data, including language. But as a practical matter, he stresses that constructing our models is not, as Joan says her mother used to say, like living in Liberty Hall, a free-for-all where anything goes and we can build castles in the sky and try to live there. She said her mother used to say to him, well, about the upstairs bedroom, what do you think it is up there, Liberty Hall? Relatively fixed parts of our experience, we all experience Speedway as farther away from 22nd Street than it is from Broadway, constrain our model making. But James argues most situations are complex enough that even given those constraints, multiple competing models are possible. On the one hand, James is interested in thinking through how we might best triage such competing models, which ones to pick and why and when and for whom. On the other hand, he's insistent that pluralism is a good thing. It's good to keep our models flexible, making room for multiple models, any one of which at some point might prove useful, and cultivating our ability not to get stuck in just one view of things. The poet Wallace Stevens, a Jamesian, used to joke about the lunatic of one idea. His extreme of logic, Stevens says, would be illogical. Like Delanka and like Suzuki on enlightenment as something we don't exactly experience, but don't exactly not experience either, James insists that the ineffable aspects of reality can never be yanked over and perfectly represented in our category systems and models. If, as a Zenni, you feel that your experience of what we provisionally call emptiness is something you can never quite grasp firmly, James is right with you. When we talk of reality independent of human thinking, then, it seems a very hard thing to find. He's not saying there's no reality outside of human thinking, but if you're a human, when we talk about reality independent of human thinking, then, it seems a very hard thing to find. It reduces to the notion of what is just entering into experience and is yet to be named, or else to some imagined original presence and experience before any belief about the presence had arisen, before any human conception had been applied. It is what is absolutely dumb, meaning unspeaking, not stupid, right? It is what is absolutely dumb and evanescent, the merely ideal limits of our mind. We may glimpse it, but we never grasp it. What we grasp is always some substitute for it, which previous human thinking has peptonized and cooked for our consumption. So you're never getting it raw, you're always getting it digested by stomach acids or by cooking. That's all right. It's true, though, that our models are most useful if they try to conform as best they can to what's out there. There's at least a check and balance of sense perception. And again, the claim would be that sense perception, as for Kant, is inside our experience, but it's relatively more fixed and stable. All right. So. The popular notion is that a true idea must copy its reality. He doesn't buy into that generally. Like other popular views, this one follows the analogy of the most usual experience. Our true ideas, and every time, I won't keep translating, every time he says sensible, he doesn't mean the opposite of nonsensical, but it's just philosophical lingo for sensory, so, okay. Our true ideas of sensible things do indeed copy them. Shut your eyes and think of yonder clock on the wall, and you get just such a true picture or copy of its dial. James glosses over here the way our five senses have always already done some processing. Elsewhere, he makes the more consequential, Lanka-like claim that our conceptual categories also always obtrude. The shorthand for this in Wittgenstein says someplace that for human beings, all seeing is a seeing as, that we're always already seeing through our categories. Except when we're having that experience that's not an experience of awakening, maybe, sort of. All right. What shall we call a thing anyhow? It seems quite arbitrary, for we carve out everything just as we carve out constellations to serve our human purposes. We break, and he's talking about each one of us individually, but also our languages have pre-done this for us. We break the flux of sensible reality into things, then, at our will. We create the subjects, and he means the nouns, right? We create the subjects of our true as well as of our false propositions. We create the predicates also, the verbs, right? Many of the predicates of things express only the relation of the things to us and to our feelings. Such predicates, of course, are human additions. You see how naturally one comes to the humanistic principle. You can't weed out the human contribution. Our nouns and adjectives are all humanized heirlooms, and in the theories we build them into, the inner order and arrangement is wholly dictated by human considerations, intellectual consistency being one of them. James's rough contemporary Nietzsche lays this distorting factor out more baldly and with a cynicism that apparently gives him more than a little delight. This is from an early essay called On Truth and Lie in an Extra Moral Sense. And I'll try to unpack this a little. Let us still give special consideration to the formation of concepts. So how do concepts get generated? Every word immediately becomes a concept inasmuch as it is not intended to serve as a reminder of the unique and wholly individualized original experience to which it owes its birth, but must at the same time fit innumerable more or less similar cases. So he's telling a myth about the origin of language that linguists don't believe in anymore, and that's the idea that names originated through our encounter with some one particular creature. Linguists, of course, can't say that that's not quite what happened, but the idea would be, so there's something in front of you and you've never seen it before and it scares you, and so you go, snake! And you know, maybe the word expresses your emotion at it, right? But then James says, well, it's not possible, except in Eden, he doesn't say that, but except in Eden where there's a finite field of objects, right? It's not possible in the world for each thing to have its separate name. If each thing had its separate name, names would be unusable. So he says, you know, if it's true, which it isn't, that the name owed its origin to some single experience, we got to start using that to name a bunch of other things like it. All right, so that's that. So what he's talking about is really class names there. All right, anyway, but must at the same time fit innumerable more or less similar cases. Just a quick sidebar. We were talking last night with John about how, according to Emerson and other language philosophers, all our names for interior reality are metaphorical because they're based on some felt similarity between something outside and something inside. So sky and mind for Hinton. What Nietzsche's saying here really is that all our concepts are metaphorical because if they're all based on likeness rather than identity, they're metaphors. And if they're metaphors, there's a lot of, you know, we don't have a choice about the nouns built into our language, but basically if they're metaphors, there's always human choosing and grouping and things might have been grouped otherwise. All right, now here's the cynicism. So he says, must at the same time fit innumerable more or less similar cases, which means, strictly speaking, never equal. In other words, a lot of unequal cases. Every concept originates through our equating what is unequal. No leaf ever wholly equals another, and the concept leaf is formed through an arbitrary abstraction from these individual differences through forgetting the distinctions. And so I think the claim there with the forgetting is that if the language doesn't mark the distinction, perceptually, you're going to tend to let it slide, you know, more likely than not, or in more cases than not. Nietzsche also insists that we perform these grouping operations with an ulterior motive in mind. Our particular distortions and judgments serve our particular purposes, which for Nietzsche are frequently nefarious, more or less purposely induced delusions. Entire cultures buy into this process while also blinding themselves to it. Nietzsche is still evidently enjoying himself. He says, what is truth? A mobile army of metaphors. So when you call it mobile, you're saying it's shifty. When you call it an army, you're saying you can screw somebody with it, right? Okay. Which after long use seem firm, canonical, and obligatory to a people. So you forget that the metaphors are metaphors. And in the most cynical moment, truths are illusions about which one has forgotten that this is what they are. All right. James, with less cynical delight, sees our purposes as typically less malign and is generating unavoidable, not purposive, distortions. But like Nietzsche, he regards our models as both constrained by our immediate sense perceptions and shaped by our purposes, by what we hope the model will help us to do. That's the instrumental part. It turns out that in most cases, the constraints imposed by the need for eventual face-to-face verification, is Speedway really closer to Broadway than to 22nd Street, are forgiving enough to allow for more than one model. There are lots of different ways to draw a map of Tucson, depending on what you want to use it for. Multiple models often agree with the reality closely enough to be potentially useful. All roads lead to Rome, and in the end and eventually, all two processes must lead to the face of directly verifying sensory experiences somewhere, which somebody's ideas have copied. So you can't judge the utility of the map unless at some point you put it up against perceptual things. Such is the large, loose way in which the pragmatist interprets the word agreement. He treats it altogether practically. He lets it cover any process of conduction from a present idea to a future terminus, provided only that it run prosperously. And one more quotation right here. In all these cases, we humanly make an addition to some sensible reality, and that reality tolerates the addition. All the additions agree with the reality. They fit it while they build it out. No one of them is false. Which may be treated as the more true depends altogether on the human use of it. If this feels too loosey-goosey, it might be useful to know that one key instigation for James's pluralistic take on model making was recent developments in science. This was the period in which theoretical physicists were generating models of subatomic particles, which instruments couldn't directly see, so you had to make inferences about them. That led James to a somewhat Lanka-like view of scientific models as, well, projections partly. It is, as I have already said, as if reality were made of ether, atoms, or electrons, but we mustn't think so literally. The term energy doesn't even pretend to stand for anything objective. It is only a way of measuring the surface of phenomena so as to string their changes on a simple formula. And here's a longer quotation. One of the most successfully cultivated branches of philosophy in our time is what is called inductive logic, the study of the conditions under which our sciences have evolved. Writers on this subject have begun to show a singular unanimity as to what the laws of nature and element of fact mean when formulated by mathematicians, physicists, and chemists. And then he's going to tell a story about how philosophers used to think about it, and so this whole paragraph is, oh, but this is all wrong. Okay, and then he'll say something else. When the first mathematical, logical, and natural uniformities, the first laws, were discovered, men were so carried away by the clearness, beauty, and simplification that resulted that they believed themselves to have deciphered authentically the eternal thoughts of the Almighty. His mind also thundered and reverberated in syllogisms, God, that is, right? He also thought in conic sections, squares, and roots and ratios, and geometrized like Euclid. He made Kepler's laws for the planets to follow. He made velocity increase proportionally to the time in falling bodies. He made the law of the signs for light to obey when refracted. He established the classes, orders, families, and genera of plants and animals and fixed the distances between them. He thought the archetypes of all things and devised their variations. And when we rediscover, and the re is the problematic thing here, I think, and when we rediscover any one of these his wondrous institutions, we seize his mind in its very literal intention. So if your model copies God's mind, you're cool. If not, throw it out. But as the sciences have developed further, the notion has gained ground that most, perhaps all, of our laws are only approximations. The laws themselves, moreover, have grown so numerous that there is no counting them, and so many rival formulations are proposed in all the branches of science that investigators have become accustomed to the notion that no theory is absolutely a transcript of reality, but that any one of them may, from some point of view, be useful. Their great use is to summarize old facts and to lead to new ones. They are only a man-made language, a conceptual shorthand, as someone calls them, in which we write our reports of nature. And languages, as is well known, tolerate much choice of expression and many dialects. Riding now on the front of this wave of scientific logic, Schiller and Dewey, John Dewey, the American pragmatist educator, Schiller and Dewey appear with their pragmatistic account of what truth everywhere signifies. Everywhere, these teachers say, truth in our ideas and beliefs means the same thing that it means in science. It means, they say, nothing but this, that ideas, which themselves are but parts of our experience, become true just insofar as they help us to get into satisfactory relation with other parts of our experience, to summarize them and get about among them by conceptual shortcuts instead of following the interminable succession of particular phenomena. Any idea upon which we can ride, so to speak, any idea that will carry us prosperously from any one part of our experience to any other, linking things satisfactorily, working securely, simplifying, saving labor, is true for just so much, true in so far forth, true instrumentally. This is the instrumental view of truth taught so successfully at Chicago, the view that truth in our ideas means their power to work, promulgated so brilliantly at Oxford. This was also a period like our own in which rapid developments in scientific instrumentation generated lots of new data. Such new information might either confirm or contradict the predictions you had made based on some particular model. This could be inconvenient, but might feel kind of Buddhist. When the observable world doesn't fit your model, what do? Rail at the world for being fucked up? Modify your model with some tinkering? Scrap the old model and devise a new one? Here's James. A new opinion counts as true just in proportion as it gratifies the individual's desire to assimilate the novel experience, the new data, to his beliefs in stock. So you have your models already, and then there's something that doesn't fit them. It, the new model, must both lean on old truth and grasp new fact. It's really hard to completely throw out your model completely and have a new one, so we tend to tinker with them. So, with the geocentric model of the solar system, new data began to, a long time ago, right, began to suggest that the perfect circle didn't apply. And so for a while, people tried to just tinker with the model by building in a couple backflips in it, you know, so you'd have a model. And at some point, the model just got so cumbersome that people had to say, well, you know, what if you remodeled it and had a heliocentric universe? But that kind of intellectual reorientation is pretty difficult and pretty rare. So often we tinker with it, you know. So anyway, it, the new model, must lean on old truth and grasp new fact. And its success, as I said a moment ago, in doing this is a matter for the individual's appreciation. When old truth grows then by new truth's addition, it is for subjective reasons. We are in the process and obey the reasons. That new idea is truest, which performs most felicitously its function of satisfying our double urgency. It makes itself true, gets itself classed as true by the way it works, grafting itself then upon the ancient body of truth, which thus grows much as a tree grows by the activity of a new layer of cambium. The true, to put it very briefly, is only the expedient in the way of our thinking, just as the right is only the expedient in the way of our behaving. Expedient in almost any fashion, and expedient in the long run and on the whole, of course, for what meets expediently all the experience in sight won't necessarily meet all further experiences equally satisfactorily. So he's talking about the need to upheave and change our models, right? To be responsive to change circumstances and information. Experience, as we know, has ways of boiling over and making us correct our present formulas. The absolutely true, meaning what no farther experience will ever alter, is that ideal vanishing point towards which we imagine that all our temporary truths will someday converge. It runs on all fours with the perfectly wise man and with the absolutely complete experience. And if these ideals are ever realized, they will all be realized together. So when the world is done, right, you can have absolutely complete experience. You can have models that will be absolutely true because there's no future data can ever contradict them. And so somebody could be absolutely wise, but don't hold your breath. Right? Okay. Meanwhile, we have to live today by what truth we can get today and be ready tomorrow to call it falsehood. Ptolemaic astronomy, Euclidean space, Aristotelian logic, scholastic metaphysics were expedient for centuries, but human experience has boiled over those limits, and we now call these things only relatively true or true within those borders of experience. Absolutely, they are false, for we know that those limits were casual and might have been transcended by past theorists, just as they are by present thinkers. So reality, as James says, often tolerates multiple ways of modeling it, and it often compels us, painful though it be, to remain alert to new evidence in the light of which our old model might seem clunky, cumbersome, or sometimes downright pernicious, a recipe not for a happy outcome, but for disaster. Maybe that's a table where physicists and Buddhists can sit down together and talk. James agrees with the projection-only boys in this regard. In conceptual thinking, there's no escape from this impasse, no way to isolate the human contribution from the bare, objective, true fact. On the one hand, there will stand reality. On the other, an account of it, which it proves impossible to better or to alter. If the impossibility of coming up with a better account prove permanent, the truth of the account will be absolute, but don't hold your breath again. Other content of truth than this I can find nowhere. Not being reality, but only our belief about reality. So this sounds a little bit like the Lanka, though it's disposing of it differently. Not being reality, but only our belief about reality. Our model will contain human elements, but these will know the non-human element in the only sense in which there can be knowledge of anything. Does the river make its banks, or do the banks make the river? Does a man walk with his right leg or with his left leg more essentially? Just as impossible may it be to separate the real from the human factors in the growth of our cognitive experience. One more point about Jamesian pragmatism and pluralism. I'm thinking of what Alok said last night about how his Cultural Revolution era business manager friend was efficient because of her consistent adherence to her single model, but also rather rigid. James implies that pragmatism's pluralist flexibility is likely to feel congenial in a democratic pluralist society, which is how he saw the US. That's maybe especially worth noting in the present political context, where those values feel so precarious. In the following quotation, I think he's using Protestant as a metaphor, thinking of its early championing of the idea that all people were free to construe the Bible for themselves rather than being forced to hew to the Pope's understanding. So you could have lots of constructions, and that was a good thing, you know, in that view of Protestantism, and he's saying that's congenial to the US, right? To shift the emphasis in this way to pragmatism means that philosophic questions will fall to be treated by minds of a less abstractionist type than heretofore, minds more scientific and individualistic in their tone, yet not irreligious either. It will be an alteration in the seat of authority that reminds one almost of the Protestant Reformation. And as to papal minds, Protestantism has often seemed a mere mass of anarchy and confusion. Such, no doubt, will pragmatism often seem to ultra-rationalist minds in philosophy. It will seem so much sheer trash philosophically. And then he actually ends with dogs. He says, but life wags on all the same and compasses its end in Protestant countries. I venture to think that philosophic Protestantism will compass a not dissimilar prosperity. So America's like this sort of happy dogs wandering around, wagging their tails, each looking for their own bone, you know. Right. That's probably plenty for tonight. The gist, I guess, is that James offers us some ways of seeing our models as projection partly, which is useful if we want to engage the world without becoming the lunatic of one idea. Jamesian pragmatism might offer some clues about how to soften our tendency to stick like glue to our single fixed picture of how things are, and thus perhaps to soften our sense of self, to soften ourselves. Not too shabby. All right, thank you. So I don't know, I mean, the wager of it is that I think a lot of our practice has to do with that Lanka-like, really sort of turning back inward and seeing thoughts rising and falling and seeing them as empty. And then, you know, when we turn back to the world, understanding that our views really, from as kind of the strictest possible view, are projection only, that they never absolutely get at things. But if you want to go to work in the world, it would be useful to have a view of your models where you thought you could use them, but where something of that, you know, sort of skepticism about their absolute truth and a sense that it would be good not to take them too seriously or get caught in any single one would really stand you in good stead. And the other wager, I don't know if this will work at all, is that you could take sort of all the abstract lingo of all this and that there's something in it that might speak to you anyway about sort of different way to hold your views, you know, and that has some relation both to how you wander around the world interacting with other people and trying to do some good as a bodhisattva type, you know, and also maybe, as we were saying last night, to the extent that you hold your concepts more softly, there's also that sense maybe that the self softens as well, that it's not so rigidly or tightly held. And that, I think, takes us back to familiar ground for Zen practice. So that's the wager of the talk. So thank you. And we have about three or four minutes for questions if there are.
Well, I mean, I already said something like this to you today. It didn't work in the room, but my mind wants to go to then. Well, how do I do it? You know, like how do I stop projecting, or at least see the projections, or
I guess what I'm suggesting is that I think if you're in full blown Zen mode, you always want to see the projections as projections, you know. If you're in pragmatist mode, you want to say, you know, how am I going to solve this problem today? And so to some extent, you have to invest in, I think, again, not the absolute truth of how you're seeing it, but the possible utility of it. But I think it makes a difference if you walk in saying, you know, this is only, just what Joan said about provisionality, you know, this is only one way to do it, this is only one model. And the other thing that's so true about often in the Koan tradition, there's the thing about, you know, if it's impossible, but do it anyway. So that the model that you're invested in is not giving you any way to do something. And, you know, Norman talks about this a lot too. I think I mentioned it last night, the sense that often the insoluble problems that we think are stuck in really are a function of the way we're modeling them, you know. And so on the one hand, it's useful just to stop modeling for a while, but also if you're, and I guess the other thing I'm suggesting is that the sort of Lanka-like training should make you a better pragmatist. Do you know, that you already have the sense that your thoughts are just your thoughts, and it's a little hard not to get carried away with the, you know, this is what I got to do about this relationship, or this is how I'm going to fix the fucked up English department, or something like that, you know. But if you have that training, maybe someplace in there you know you're ready for, oh, this doesn't fit the model, and things shift. And I think also the training maybe gives us a sense that it's not a great thing to be so incredibly invested in our models. I mean, we're so used to that, right? You know, it's like, oh, that's just what I was thinking. And I, you know, I don't think it's an easy fix at all. So that, I mean, that's why it's a sort of theoretical talk. I mean, I don't know how to tell anybody really how to do that in their own lives. I mean, work in the room, we could chat about it, you know. But as a sort of general framework, I think it really is something, especially for Joan's students, you know, that we carry around with us, this sort of loosely, you know, pragmatistic way of trying to hold our concepts loosely and not be constrained and pushed around by him too much. So one thing I didn't talk about at all, since I was trying to lay out sort of an epistemological model, is all the emotive stuff and karma, right? I mean, so obviously, in addition to your nouns and verbs, they're incredible, you know, sort of hedged in ways that we model things based on our own experience. And again, you know, so you know, do you need to go to therapy for that? Yeah. Is Zen of some use for that? Probably, right? You know, because again, it tends to loosen that stuff up, and also loosen this sort of, you know, dog shreds the towel tenacity, which we think will die if our view turns out not to be right. You know. Yeah, Fred. Yeah.
So I sat in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition for a while, and they had this additional set of precepts called the 14 mindfulness trainings. And one of them was interesting. It was non-attachment to views. And I can't remember the verbiage of it, but essentially it basically stated, do not attach to views, even Buddhist ones. I remember that.
Yeah.
And they said they are meant to be skillful means, but they're not ideas to fight or die for.
I'm going to talk about that on Friday a little bit, just in terms of sort of taking a Jamesian view of Shinto.
Yeah.
That is, how do you take the conceptual structure in Shinto and say, you know, let's hold it lightly, right? You know, So let me say one. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I see that's ironically, that's a model telling us to question our minds.
That's right. Yeah.
And I really appreciate that. Yeah. The something I've always appreciated about Zen is just questioning is front and center.
Yeah. Let me say one other thing since you mentioned it, and I'll probably forget, otherwise I was going to mention it tomorrow. But I think the talk on Saturday is going to be shorter. I can't promise, you know, but I'm going to try really hard to make it shorter. And I thought at some point, especially if I give you advance warning, we could turn off the recording from the talk, which I want to keep, and you know, often we put them up on the website, and then start another recording that's for our use only. And I had like the loose framework is sort of what if you have some tricks up your sleeve, like the Thich Nhat Hanh thing that you just mentioned, that in some way are devices you use for sort of moving back into the world of multiplicity and karma and the nirmanakaya and causes and conditions and all that, while maintaining something of that sort of perspective of emptiness or the vastness. And so that's one really good one. And I thought I had like three or four that I'll mention, partly in relation to some of the stuff in the Uchiyama that I want to bring in briefly. But I thought we could just sort of, you know, sort of compile them, and then we would only do it by agreement, but we could sort of, you know, somebody could cull the recording, and we could pull together a list and send it around to everybody and say, would it be okay if we, you know, put it out as a pamphlet that we share, you know, not a pamphlet, but like a little tiny thing that we share among ourselves. So it's like, what are your, you know, whether you've thought of them yourself or learned it from somebody else, what are some of the little sort of portable koans or sort of, you know, 1 minute Zen exercises that you do to sort of not completely lose that perspective and allow it to kind of soften your opinionated views, I mean, that kind of thing. So I invite you to do that, and I'll try to remind people tomorrow, but if I forget, you know, please feel free to do it. Yeah, look.
I just want to connect the question they asked me about what my success rate
yeah.
is to relate to what we just talked about. And if I were to answer you, I would say my success rate is 100%.
Okay.
Because if you don't, if you're not just looking for something as success, you can discover what the painting reveals
great.
To you.
Yeah, thank you.
You could discover your projection, for example.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. You could discover, so you use it as a Zen Rosha test.
That's great.
That's we can use that's anything
great.
As a
that's
Zen
great.
Rosha
that's great. That's wonderful. Yeah, thank
anything
you.
That we put out.
That's great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But thank the pragmatist part of that is, do you throw some of them out? Do you throw some of your successes out?
Why not?
Why not?
So you do. Okay.
That's good.
I had a thought. I had been reading these theories about the beginning of language, which the ones that I was reading talk about shamans trying, you know, having these non-ordinary experiences and then having to explain them or having transmit them to, you know, people.
That's great.
And so it seems that, you know, now these many eons later, we've kind of reversed that
yeah.
process.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Thank you.
So do we have any more time?
If we just go to closing the hall and the vows, we got about 5 or 10 more minutes, right? Because it only takes about 5. So we have a little more time.
So my question, it was sort of a point of clarification, so I'm trying to get what projection is, and my understanding of projection is that you're taking a desire or a concept that you hold internally and projecting it out into the world and seeing that out there. So assuming that that's something close to the definition of projection, then is what then would be the to the extent that we Buddhists might be thought of as seeking enlightenment or kensho, what are we projecting?
Oh, Yeah, that's great. So I want to say something else in a second, but yeah. So here's the way I know how to answer that, right? So what Joan used to say, right, is when all your ideas about what enlightenment is fall away in a retreat, then what walks toward you on the bare ground, that's it. So, and I tried to talk about that last night using some of the Suzuki stuff and also some things from Norman. We were talking about the Lanka last night. And
the sutra?
Yeah, and my understanding is that, so first of all, as Norman says, in one of his talks he says, yeah, that's what we usually mean by projection in the West, right? And that the Lanka's view is sort of includes that, but it's more sweeping. So that really any cognitive production, right, being a function of our own cognitive structure and language and so on, in addition to our own desires, is, the Lanka says, projection only. So it takes a sweeping view and says, you know, whatever you're conceptualizing about what's out there, it's not what's out there. And what I was trying to do today with the James is to sort of say, well, yeah, absolutely that's true, but there's still a way in which, you know, our models can put us in productive touch. And so I was sort of joking around with projection partly. But what the Lanka suggests is that when that stuff falls away, and there are ways to do that, then, and you know, I think this is maybe problematic, but the idea is there's something that happens that isn't exactly a conceptual experience, right? And as you know from the Sandokai stuff with Suzuki, he talks about enlightenment as something that we can't actually experience, but we don't not experience it either, or we don't experience it, but we realize it. You know, so he talks about it really as this thing that isn't an activity of knowing, that it's something else that happens. And I think, I mean, in my own experience, that's a good account, and I tried to evoke it last night. I think probably there's usually some admixture, you know? I mean, I don't know, it's always like sort of purely non-conceptual, but there's something that happens that isn't really caught in that conceptual net, and it's that thing, I think, that gives you the shivers or changes you in some way. And then the cool thing is the Lanka says, well, so what then, you know? So, and it says, well, so then you hit this thing which is perfected reality. But it turns out perfected reality is just when your projections return, which they always will, you realize them as projections. So in a way you have to use them, but you know that they're fictions. And then what I was trying to do tonight is saying, well, given that, some of the fictions might be better to use than others. And James sort of offers us some way for sorting. By fiction, I just mean model, you know, that it's not in any absolute sense literally true. So is that kind of an answer to that?
Kind of,
okay. Do you want to ask?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Anything else? All right, thank you very much. And let's, I guess we're going to restore the hall or not bother, or what? What do you want to?
What do you want to do?
Well, we're going to walk the stick.
Okay, then we should restore and, the hall.
Okay, yeah. Let's restore the hall. Thank you. Okay. Alok, thanks again for the presentation.
Yeah, that's right.